Blog Talk Radio.
Ah, there it is. The holy grail of Christmas gifts, the Red Ryder 200-shot range model air rifle.
Yeah, we're checking that list, maybe even twice. Are you naughty or are you nice? Welcome aboard the Amy Beth Arkley Show, weaving together a holiday mosaic of voices from the arts, pop culture, personal growth, and justice. Take it easy out there. That ice storm we talked about last week, it came east. So navigating around may be putting a damper into your holiday bustle. I hope not. I'll tell you, I had a very merry meeting with a enthusiastic book club known as the Sleuth Sisters over the weekend. Very enthusiastic. About Killing Time, the first in the Eliza Gordon mystery series, so we're very happy about that. They're going to delve into the second one, Dead Silent for the Spring. I'll clue you in on how your book club can get involved in all the fun. Speaking of fun and hard work, the Inspiration to Action Challenge has been going on since September, so the success stories are already pouring in. We'll check on a few of those. And yeah, I can talk. My mouth is working on a Monday schedule. We also have the Free Flow Pop Culture Convo, where a brother-sister duo just made history over the weekend. Details to follow. Fan fave Patrick Moore is back with us from the popular All Things Crime blog to talk about the Christmas season crime docket from Zimmerman to Arias, Skakel to Knox, which notorious characters are getting a lump of coal in their stocking, and which ones may have gotten away with something. We'll talk. Also, some holiday songs thrown into the mix. And by the way, you want to be in the mix if you're listening live. That would be Monday, December 9th at 9 a.m. out west, 11 Central, noon here in the east. Please give us a call, 347-857-4505. Also, Aurora's over at the Twitter feed for you at AB Writes. Our first guest, though, Kevin Jakubowski, is a comic writer known for TV work, film work, and now a new book out called 8-Bit Christmas. It is being billed as a Christmas story for the Nintendo generation. So you're already traipsing on hallowed ground, Kevin. Welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm great, Amy Beth. Thanks for having me.
A pleasure. But I guess as a humorist and a comic writer, you know, you want to, if you're going to traipse on any ground, it might as well be hallowed ground, right?
Yeah, I guess. Yeah, you just want to do it justice, you know? I mean, A Christmas Story is such a legendary, wonderful film, and, you know, obviously all the work of Gene Shepard and his writing is so, you know, revered. So, you know, you kind of have to be careful.
Yeah, you got to be careful. But this obviously was a story that meant something to you as a child, I'm assuming, growing up. And is that what inspired you to take it on kind of in your own model, in your own fashion?
Oh, definitely, yeah. I mean, you know, the book is in some ways an homage to A Christmas Story, but really it's, you know, more its own story, you know, more tied to my childhood and, you know, growing up. And I think, you know, kids of the 80s having such this love for Nintendo. You know, I didn't think there had really been anything that had touched on that yet. And so I thought I'd take a crack at it.
So give us the setup. What's the basics of the story without giving too much away?
Sure. No problem. It's set in the late 1980s. It's about a 9-year-old kid named Jake Doyle. It's narrated, and that's where I think the A Christmas Story comparison kind of comes in. It's narrated by an adult narrator looking back. So it's in the vein of A Christmas Story and, you know, The Wonder Years or Stand By Me or The Sandlot, movies like that. It's about Jake and his quest for Nintendo. He lives in a town where there's only one kid in town, this rich kid named Timmy Clean, who has a Nintendo, and he kind of makes all the neighborhood kids pay him to play. And so it's about all these kids trying to get Nintendo for Christmas, and sort of the crux of the story comes when Timmy Clean, I think we all knew a kid like this growing up, he's kind of a spaz, you know, the spoiled sort of brat, and anytime he plays Nintendo, he kind of gets really worked up. He gets so worked up one day that he's also a karate enthusiast. He jump kicks his own TV, which falls on his very annoying dog and crushes the dog. The town goes crazy. They blame video game violence for it, and they ban Nintendo for Christmas. So now, you know, it's really tough for these kids to get one for Christmas, and it's about Jake and his buddies and how they figure out on how to get a Nintendo for Christmas.
Now you're like a Christmas story meets Footloose now.
Yes, kind of. You know, you can't dance. You got to dance, you know. So yeah. I mean, it's really, in a nutshell, it's a sort of a comic look back at the kid pop culture of the 1980s.
So the audience is really not kids so much, or maybe adults reading the story to kids, but it's really maybe for it's more of an adult audience that would be looking back nostalgically at their childhood?
Yes, it's definitely for adults. I mean, I think kids 12 and up would enjoy it as well. But, you know, it's a look back. It's sarcastic and, you know, it touches on everything from Muppet Babies to Nintendo to baseball cards to, you know, the Reagan administration. So, I mean, it's a book that kids, it's about kids in the way that, you know, say Roddy Doyle's Patty Clark, Ha Ha Ha, or trying to think of any other books. You know, it's about kids, but it's for adults.
Yes, so it's a good book for people who have, you know, a sense of humor and want to have sort of a look back nostalgically with a patina of comedy, I guess, towards their youth.
Yes, exactly right. You said it much better than I did.
There you go. Well, you know, I'm giving you the plug. I'm a professional shill. It's okay. Who were your influences? Now, obviously, Christmas Story comes into play, at least by the people who are reading it or critiquing it or promoting it. But maybe there's some other inspiration that you have in terms of your own influences for this book and for your other work.
Sure, yeah. No, I think, I come from a film background, so most of my influences are film-related or television-related. But, you know, Gene Shepard, the author of A Christmas Story, which comes from In God We Trust, and, you know, Fistful of Fig Newtons and books like that, I was definitely, you know, his voice, I think I've always kind of had a similar sort of style to him, so I've always really admired his work. You know, growing up, obviously, watching A Christmas Story and then learning more about him. I'm a big fan of Roddy Doyle's work. He wrote, like, The Commitments and The Snapper and The Van. He's an Irish author. I'm a big John Hughes fan, too. So I think, that kind of comes across in the writing, I think. So those are some of my bigger influences.
Now, what made you make the transition? You've been working on Comedy Central, Nickelodeon, other projects for TV and film. What made you make the transition to write a novel? Was that something you always wanted to do, or you just said, you know, I have an idea, this seems to be more of a narrative form?
No, that's a good question. Yeah, I started working on this, on A Christmas as a feature, I kind of came to the conclusion, as a feature writer especially, most of what any feature writer writes never gets made. And there's just so much that kind of goes into, you know, every movie that gets made is like a minor miracle, I feel like. And, you know, there's so much money that's needed to make a movie. And this was something that I thought, this is a story I really, really want to tell. I want to control it. I want to be able to get it to an audience. And I thought that it might be very suited for as a book, and that allowed me, I thought, a clear path to get it, you know, to an audience.
Yeah, and then, of course, if it's successful as a book, you might have an easier path to get it into the movies, too, right?
Exactly. It's crazy how Hollywood loves books. I mean, if it's a terrible book, sometimes they're like, well, we'll just make it a better movie. So,
well, you know, my theory is really the worse the book is, the better the movie is, because if it's a really good book, it's harder to live up to that and get it all in. I always use The Bridges of Madison County as an example, because that was not the greatest book, although it sold really well, but it was a phenomenal movie. So yeah, that always works out, or not always, but can work out. But it's interesting, because we've had a lot of filmmakers on the show who talk about, and a lot of them are indie filmmakers, looking, you know, they use Kickstarter, they do all kinds of things to get their movies made. A lot of people don't realize how daunting it is to get a movie made, and how the other side, when you talk about being a feature writer, a lot of people live in what they call development hell. They get paid the option or whatever, the movie just sits on the shelf. So yeah, if you want to see your work out there, it's great to get paid, but you want to see the work eventually get it into the audience, get to the public.
No, it did. That's definitely true. I mean, there's just it's so frustrating to have, you know, something that you spend a year writing, you know, and you're getting paid for it and stuff, and it's your job, and that's awesome. You definitely can't complain about that. But then the only 20 people that read it are development execs. You know what I mean? So with a book, you could get it out a lot, you know, hopefully to a bigger audience.
Yeah, so good for you for doing that. And you never know. It may wind up it'll go head to head with A Christmas Story in another couple of years.
Maybe.
Maybe you have your own marathon. What are your favorite now, beside A Christmas Story? Now that we're in the season, what are your other favorite holiday movies and TV shows? You have any?
I've always been a big fan of Home Alone. I was about the same age as Kevin McAllister when that came out, so I love that. And obviously, you know, it's set in Chicago, the Chicago area where I'm from. That's a great Christmas movie. You got it. You know, It's a Wonderful Life. Can't go wrong with that one. Trying to think what other good ones there are. There's so many. I always love the Charlie Brown Christmas. I try to watch that every year.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, I'm just kind of a. Yeah, they really are. They've been playing for 40 some years or 50 years even. I'm a Christmas junkie, so I love this time of year. It's definitely my favorite time of year. People smile more. People are nicer. I love it.
Yeah, me too. And I love the music because as someone in radio, I used to be full time as a DJ, and I never get sick of Christmas music because you play it a lot over the Christmas holiday. But that's it. And it's over.
Yeah. Yeah, no.
Except those stations where they start after Halloween playing it nonstop. That's
right.
I never worked for one of those.
You gotta ease into it. Yes.
Yeah, you gotta ease into it.
Yeah, Christmas music. Yeah, that's great. That's fantastic.
It is a good season. I wish you the best with this book. It sounds like a fun read, and I hope you're going to do well with it. And you know, you never know. It may show up on the small or big screen in the future, the way things work. And you have your other projects. You're working on something now for Nickelodeon. Is that right?
Yes, I'm writing, developing two pilots for them. One's an animated one, and one's a live action one. Both comedies. So making a kids show is something I always wanted to do, and it's been a fun process so far.
All right, that's the only kind of hint we're going to get because you don't want to jinx it.
I don't want to jinx. And honestly, I think Nickelodeon might shoot us both if I said something about it. It's very top secret over there. They're very. They know what they're doing, that's for sure, but I don't really know what the rule is about talking about it, so I'm just going to not give specifics.
Okay, I understand. Well, I always say when something's in progress, also you diffuse the energy of it. Certainly as a writer, you know, when you're working on something, you don't want to talk about it too much. At least that's my theory. There are some people that love to blab about their work, and they don't care, and they talk it out, and maybe it helps them, and, you know, there's no one-size-fits-all, I suppose. But
right. It's almost superstition sometimes, I feel like, if you talk about it too much before it, you know, actually gets greenlit or airs or whatever,
I'm a big jinx theory person too. So we'll pretend we never mentioned that. Okay,
perfect.
It never happened. But 8-Bit Christmas has happened. It's out there in the market. I think a lot of people have already said some wonderful things about it, and you can get it now. Do you have a website for this devoted to it?
It's just my website, kevin-jakubowski.com. You can check out 8-Bit Christmas on Goodreads. You can buy it on Amazon or Barnes & Noble. A bunch of other places. So that's where you can get the book.
Cool. And I'm sure people will enjoy it. It'll be a good read for folks who are looking for a little nostalgia and maybe passing on the traditions of their youth to their kids. So you have that kind of, you want to get the multi-generational thing going already, right?
Yeah, definitely. It's a great
I'm giving you some promo advice here.
I appreciate that. No, that's good. I'm learning as I go. But it's a fantastic book, a great Christmas gift. If you're in your 30s, you'll love this book for sure.
There you go, and you'll pass it down or pass it up. You know, you want to try to get as many people involved as you can.
Yes, for everybody. Small children, people who can read, people who can't read, elves, everybody. I love it.
Oh, the young, you know, the alive, the dead, it's good for everybody. 8-Bit
exactly.
Christmas, fun book, fun read. It's a new author who is also a TV and film writer, Kevin Jakubowski. Thank you so much for joining us. I wish you the best, and Merry Christmas, Happy Holidays. Come back and see us again.
Thanks very much, Amy. Take care.
Take care. Bye-bye. Check it out. It sounds like a fun read. Stepping on Harold Brown, but I think he's onto something. Hey, this is Amy of the Dark Wee Show. Give us a call, 347-857-4505. Hit us up on Twitter at AD Writes. We've got the Inspiration to Action Challenge Success Stories, Free Flow Pop Culture Convo, and our fan fave, Patrick Moore, with the Christmas Season Crime Doc and all ahead.
Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah, Kwesi Kwanzaa, a tip-top Tet, and a solemn, dignified Ramadan. Now a word from my God, our sponsor.
A message from the U.S. Postal Service.
You know, the holidays are always a busy time for us at the post office. That's why we'd like to remind you, even though there are many days left until Christmas, if you expect your cards and packages to arrive in time, mail of today, or you're out of luck, pal.
This reminder from your post office, who wants to know, have you been PO'd lately?
Every day I wake up, pour myself a cup of that rich Folgers aroma.
The best part of waking up,
it's the
doo-wop, doo-wop, it all I do.
The mango aroma always coming through. Now I'm right in harmony with that doo-wop, doo-wop ditty. Whoa, one more cup and it's a hoo-wop, shoo-wop for me. Oh, the best part of waking up is Folgers in your cup. The best part of waking up is Folgers in your cup.
Snap. What a happy sound. Snap is the happiest sound I've found. You may clap, rap, clap, clap, but snap makes the world go round. Snap, crackle, Rice Krispies. I say it's crackle, the crispy sound. You gotta have crackle or the clock's not wound. Geese cackle, feathers tickle, belts buckle, beef pickle, but crackle makes the world go round. Snap, crackle, Rice Krispies. I insist that pop's the sound. The best is missed unless pop's around. You can't stop hopping when the cereal's popping. Pop makes the world go round. Snap, crackle, pop, Rice Krispies. Snap, crackle, pop, Rice Krispies. Kellogg's best to you.
Ladies, it's Christmas time at Gilt Brothers Diamonds.
Make him buy you a diamond for Christmas.
We'll teach you the four C's of diamond shopping.
Covet, crave, cry, coerce.
Remember the two-month salary rule.
If he spends less than 2 months' salary on your diamond, he doesn't really love you.
Bring in one of his payroll stubs.
We'll make sure you get every dollar of diamond he can afford.
Gilt Brothers Diamonds. Because if he won't buy you a diamond for Christmas...
He's scum.
Oh my God. It's snowing. It's snowing!
Over the ground lies a mantle of white. A heaven of diamonds shine down through the night. Two hearts are thrilling in spite of the chill and the weather. Love knows no season, love knows no clime. Romance can blossom any old time. Here in the open, we're walking and hoping together. Sleigh bells ring.
Sings the love song as we go along.
you know, walking in that winter wonderland, the Eurythmics on the Amy Beth Arkowitz Show. Welcome back. And don't forget, we have our Jolly Holiday Special coming up on Friday, December 20th, and thereafter for podcast. We're going to feature all your favorite holiday songs, some mirth and merriment from the season. And we need your requests, though, and your dedications in by this Friday, December 13th. We got another Friday the 13th in the offing. But, you know, we had a few of those this year, and it kind of makes sense since it is 2013. It's symmetrical or synergistic or something. Anyway, the elves are already working. The TCS elves, Trudy, Aurora, ML at headquarters, already working on the special. So get those requests and dedications into us by this Friday via the website, amybetharkowee.com. You know, just click on that little contact icon and let us know what you'd like to hear. If you have a dedication, we'll do our best to get it on for you. Or you can do so via the Twitter feed at abwrites. Just give me the hashtag holidays, H-O-L-I-D-A-Z-E. So it just stands out from other comments and connections, so we'll see it. And get your song on if we can find it. We got some goodies lined up for you. It'll be a lot of fun, again, coming up Friday, the 20th of December, airing live at noon Eastern time, and then thereafter available for podcast for your holiday enjoyment. And we're certainly having fun playing it for you, for sure. Okay, last night, history was made in the nation's capital. Shirley MacLaine was honored as part of the Kennedy Center honorees, which also included Billy Joel, Carlos Santana, Herbie Hancock, opera star Maria Arroyo. But Shirley MacLaine made history because she and her baby brother Warren Beatty are now the only brother and sister to be official Kennedy Center honorees. Warren was honored. I guess you don't win it, you receive it. It was bestowed upon him a few years ago. So we'll get to see the celebration. They always, they never air it live. I guess they edit it out. It will be airing on CBS on the 29th of December, I believe. I don't know the times. Check your local listings. But it's always a fascinating show. So congratulations to all the recipients. Well-deserved. Some icons in the performing arts, for sure. Speaking of arts and inspiration and getting yourself back in the groove of your creativity and your productivity, we've done our Inspiration to Action Challenge. We started in September to sort of shake up your attitude and the way you look at things and your approach. And it's working for a lot of folks, so I am so happy when people check in with me via email and Twitter and Facebook with their success stories. So we're sharing them as we get them, and we have a few folks this week who've checked in. Tony in Omaha. Well, look, we have listeners all over the country. Tony says that she has started a new project. She says it is a series of books for children that she thinks is unique. She has written the first one and drafted out the rest of the series. So, Tony, congratulations. Good luck with the project, and please keep us posted. I love to hear that kind of stuff. And Francisco in Brooklyn, New York, tells me he is organizing poetry slams and putting out a chapbook of poetry that he just finished, and he started in September with us, with our challenge. So thank you, Francisco. Congratulations. That's a remarkable achievement. I wish you all the best. Please keep us posted if you are doing the challenge and it's working for you, or if you have any creativity coaching questions, or maybe you said, hey, you know, I don't get it. I didn't do it yet. Can I start? You can start anytime from where you are. If you want details and assistance, please reach out via the website, amybetharkowee.com. And, of course, you can always hit us on Twitter at abwrites. So happy when it works for folks. And congratulations to all who have participated, because it is, I hope it works for you. I mean, it's designed for you to just embrace your inner child and your inner artist and run with it, and apparently it has worked for at least some folks, and I am so gratified when that happens. So congratulations, everybody, and thank you so much for checking in with us and keeping us posted. By the way, if you want to start, as I said, start anytime. Just get yourself one of those old-fashioned journal notebooks. You know, we talked about it with the journaling challenge. This just sort of gives you more steps to go along. And basically, every day, you just sit down, whenever you want to, and write down one thing that brings you sheer joy, one thing for which you are inspired, one thing that you're grateful for. And then we asked you at some point to sort of weave in an act of kindness that either you've bestowed upon someone or someone has bestowed upon you. And then you got to get down to the real work, where you set out three goals that you think you can achieve within, say, a three-month period, and then set out 3 to 5 steps, action steps, to get to achieve those goals. And that's pretty much how you do it, and then just get set to tackle each step. And it's not a miracle. It's not miraculous. It just happens because you're doing the work. But this helps you put it out as a blueprint for that work and to try to get the work done. And I think as you start, the inspiration and the joy and the gratitude is to really reignite your spirit and to shake up the way you look at the world. Sometimes if you're down in the dumps or you feel like you can't be productive or you can't get anything done or no one cares about your work, that's when you feel creatively paralyzed and you can't get moving, you can't go to the next level. But by doing the challenge and getting your juices flowing, you see what happens. And some of these success stories that have poured in really are so gratifying to me. So thank you so much for participating and making it work. And if you're just starting out, get going. And please keep us posted. And, of course, if you need any help and assistance along the way, I'm here to help. And, of course, also, I just want to make sure everyone knows, we don't mention anybody's name or their situation unless they give us permission to do so. So if you'd like a shout-out, we give it to you. If you'd rather not, that's okay, too. I'm a big believer in confidentiality. But some people like to share their good news, and I'm all for that because I think it helps inspire other people, and it also gives you a lift, too, to know that people are watching and saying, hey, giving you a pat on the back, you're doing a great job. And it is the season. It's a crazy season. I know it's stressful for a lot of folks, too, because some people just feel it's joyous. People, I think, as Kevin was saying earlier, you know, people do seem to be a little nicer. But sometimes people get cranky, too, if they're in the stores, because if you're fighting to get that last Nintendo, last video game, whatever the hot game is right now, it's not Cabbage Patch Kids, right? They're not popular anymore, are they? Okay, I'm dating myself again, but it's okay. Viewmasters? That's even worse. But, you know, whatever the hot toys are, they're jostling to get them, get everything you need. Some people feel like they have to outprice each other, you know, outshine. Spend what you can. Spend what you can afford. Spend what you're comfortable with. Do what you can and try to remember the value of the holiday season and being in touch with your friends, your family, the true meaning of the season for whatever that may be for you. But, you know, yeah, I know. The kids are on the list and they're looking for gifts. What can you do?
The hottest toys of the holidays are at Toys R Us. Kids love roller coasters.
Whee!
And kids love to design their own roller coasters on the computer.
It's fun!
Introducing the Stock Market Computer Sim Coaster, where the hills and thrills follow the market.
Just type in the Dow Industrial Averages and the program does the rest.
Up it goes!
Oh, boy!
And then, just like the stock market, it goes down fast.
Woohoo!
Then it goes up a little bit, and then it goes down again real far.
Uh-oh.
And then it goes down again.
Oh, I feel sick.
And down again.
It's gonna crash! Call my broker!
How low can it go? The Stock Market Computer Sim Coaster. New this Christmas. Only at Toys R Us.
Sell everything!
We want Toys R Us.
Toys R Us, yeah, you know that feeling. Hey, welcome back. It is the Amy Beth Arkwright Show, 347-857-4505. Patrick Moore, the founder of the All Things Crime Blog, joins us in a moment. First, we'll take a quick caller. Hey there, welcome aboard.
Hi there. I just wanted you to know that the Cabbage Patch Kids are not dead. They're celebrating 30th anniversary.
Cabbage Patch Kids 30th anniversary. God bless them. I love those Cabbage Patch Kids. I wonder if they'll have that furor. When they first came out, there was a big furor over them. So I wonder if that'll
happen
again.
Absolutely, but I don't know. But now they're worth a lot of money if anybody has them from 30 years ago or in between.
What are they worth?
But they have anniversary ones now, and they're very expensive.
I see. Well, and if you find a vintage one on eBay or something, maybe you can negotiate.
Right. I just thought you'd like to know. Enjoying
okay,
your program. Looking forward to hearing Patrick Moore.
All right, he's coming up next. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Appreciate the call. Bye-bye. All right, so the Cabbage Patch Kids are back. You got to love them. Hey, welcome to the show. Patrick, what is your favorite Cabbage Patch Kid?
My favorite Cabbage Patch Kid?
One
of the floppy-eared ones.
Well, that would be a Muppet, I think. Okay, never mind. Patrick,
I'm afraid that's out of my league.
How are you?
Oh, I'm good. It's been a crazy morning, but I'm good. Looking forward to talking.
It's always a crazy morning for you because you're busy keeping up with all these criminals, and there are lots of them out there who are doing all kinds of crazy things. I know there was a story that I think you had it on your website, and one of our tipsters, Pinky, tipped me off yesterday to this story, the Craigslist thrill kill couple that I know you just did a big article on. Tell us a little bit about this. This is a gruesome story out of Pennsylvania just in time for the holidays.
Well, the amazing thing, what constantly startles me is, you know, we have citizens who are just so strange. I mean, I start the article with just like a quick rundown. Why do people get married? It could be passion. It could be they want to raise a family. They may even get married just for the hell of it. But here, these people, part of their goal in getting married was to lure someone and murder him. Not only that, but the guy's wife was a... She was like an escort, And he made a big point when he finally confessed to the police of pointing out that, yes, she's an escort. She makes $50 to $850 per time that she escorts these, like, unhappily married guys, but she doesn't sleep with them. She's not a hooker. And they engage in delightful conversation. That's what got me. They engage in delightful conversation, and here they are, you know, they lure this guy and murder the guy who, you know, purportedly is expecting some good conversation. So it's just strange.
So she's not a murderer. She's not a prostitute. She's just a murderer.
Exactly.
This is their whole thing.
And that's what's so funny. Here he is. He's like defending her honor, and they've just, you know, killed this poor sucker.
Well, originally, I believe she was just arrested, and he was defending her that it was a rape situation, that she was sending off a rapist, and it was self-defense, right? That was
There's a lot of different early versions, and then slowly but surely it appears that the truth came out. She said at one point that she picked the guy up herself, and he wasn't even involved, so she tried to protect him as well. So they definitely, as a loyal husband and wife should, they, you know, they did try to protect each other for what it was worth, but the story, you know, quickly evolved. I'm sure that the police leaned on them a bit. They certainly leaned on him a bit. And, you know, so, and then it was funny when he went into court. It's interesting how different states handle initial hearings. He went in and appeared before the judge at 9:23 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on Friday evening when he was arrested. I mean, that would never happen here in California, to the best of my knowledge. They'd hold him for a couple of days, and he'd, you know, come up for a prelim on Monday or Tuesday of the following week.
Right, yeah.
Walked in the courtroom, so he kind of shrugged and waved to the newsmen, and, you know, like it was all just kind of a lark.
Yeah, very strange. I mean, you have to, obviously there were some people, I know I just read an account where someone said, I don't know if it was in your article or another article that someone sent me, about this guy who they said was really a normal guy at first, and then he started taking drugs. I don't know if they're building up a defense for a drug, I mean, there's no defense for that anyway, but if they're going to blame it on that. It's just so odd that these people would do this and would find thrill in it. I mean, obviously, thrill kill is nothing new. We'll go back to Leopold and Loeb. I mean, and probably even before that. I mean, I guess there's just some people that have this need to do it. I guess maybe it's a playing God thing, feel what it looks like to destroy life. I don't know. It's not part of my makeup thing, God.
Goes along with that is the extraordinary belief that they would somehow get away with it.
Get away with it, yeah.
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that getting away with it is also part of it, but I just don't even understand what makes you... See, I can understand some people thinking to get away with it for a financial crime or something, if you're greedy
or even if you're needy.
That makes... I could say, all right, it was stupid, they shouldn't have done it, how do they think they can get away with it? But when you start talking about somebody murdering someone, and especially this kind of brutal, random thrill-kill murder, we're not talking about any motivation like this person did something wrong to me or something, a misguided or otherwise notion, I just find that it's really difficult for a normal person to wrap their head around, and that's why we're fascinated
by it. Exactly. Why did they do it? Where is the motivation? It makes no sense.
It kind of is.
And what's interesting is, in doing the crime blog, I've come to realize that there are a fair number of people in society that are not unlike this particular couple at all. Yeah. I mean, it takes a different form every time. There was the story I covered a month or two ago about the young people. I believe it was in Illinois. It was a couple of dead-end guys and a young woman, it's kind of similar in a way, because she lured a couple of guys to her house with the promise of sex and or drugs, and then the three guys and her, then they killed these two guys, and these guys were just, you know, kind of like, you know, dumbos, just, you know, looking for some fun or whatever. They killed them. And then it was kind of like quasi-necrophilia. Then they all had sex together on the dead bodies of the people they just killed.
Gosh.
I made the point, you know, when I wrote that post, you know, you always include images, pictures, and you could just tell from looking at these young people that they, you know, there was an arrogance, there was a blankness, a kind of zombie arrogance about them, and which is just, I mean, and that's frightening.
It's like an emptiness, and there's no soul there.
And emptiness combined with attitude. It's like it's a deadly combination.
Yeah. That's a deadly combination, exactly. Well, it kind of reminds me, reminiscent of that, remember that Canadian couple, Carla? I forget her last name.
Oh, well, sure. We've covered Carla endlessly.
Was it Homolka? Is that the last name? I forget the
Yeah,
last
Carla
name.
Homolka, yeah. We've done Homolka, seven
yeah.
or eight posts on Carla, and we just did one of my new contributors, a brilliant writer named Liz LaSalle. This is very interesting. What she did is her post, and it's unlike anything that I've ever seen published on Carla anywhere, and I know the Carla case, you know, fairly well. The thrust of her post was that, hey, Carla, she did her time. Sure, she got a sweetheart deal, but that was the deal. She did her 12 years. She did every day of it. She was released. And since then, and that was, you know, years ago now, there is no evidence she has not been a good citizen.
Let's set this up for our listeners who may not know the story. Just give us the quick thumbnail.
Very, very good point. I mean, this is probably the best-known serial killer sex rape case in Canadian history. And what happened, Carla Homolka was a young woman in St. Catharines, which I believe is a suburb of Toronto. And she's kind of, you know, she's kind of a wild child in a way, perhaps. We did a post about, was Carla Homolka a normal child? And, you know, we suggest that she was not. She went through various phases. She went through the punk rock phase. She went through the studious phase. She was different. So anyway, at about the age of 17 or so, she meets a very charismatic, handsome young man named Paul Bernardo. And Paul is like, Paul is a dreamboat. He's handsome, he's charming. And so they become involved. And Carla falls head over heels for him. And before long, his sadistic side starts to surface. Now, it turns out, before he had met Carla, there was a shadowy figure known as the Scarborough Rapist. Scarborough, I believe, is also a suburb of Toronto. And so he had been raping schoolgirls for perhaps as much as several years before he met Carla. And then what was very weird, he kind of lures Carla into his web, and so she joins in, and she eventually they kidnap two girls and rape them and torture them and kill them, and that's what the case is built on. She also, Paul Bernardo wanted to have sex with Carla's younger sister, so Carla agrees, and they give her, she worked for a veterinarian, they give her some kind of, you know, like knockout drops to put her under, and it goes wrong, and she smothers and dies. So that was, you know, very, you know, like, you know, horrific. So in any event, finally, Paul's treatment of Carla becomes more and more brutal as time passes, and eventually he beats her up so badly that she's reluctant to, but she goes to the authorities. She, you know, makes the decision. And so she goes to the authorities, and they had been interested in Paul, but, you know, he was somewhat of a suspect, but they didn't have anything solid. And so she basically talks about what he's done. And in return for that, she gets a good plea agreement. She gets a 12-year deal and a couple of manslaughter charges, and they ignore the death of her little sister. And so she testifies against Paul at his trial. And without her, they had no case. They could not bring murder charges or really any charges against Paul Bernardo without Carla. So she testified. She did her 12 years, and then she was released. Now, the interesting thing about this case, and this has been a huge controversy on All Things Crime Blog in the last 4 or 5 days, is the hatred, the vitriol of Carla toward Carla on part of Carla followers is just absolutely astounding. And that's one of the big themes we've been exploring on the blog in the recent past months is, what is it? Why are there so many crime fans who not only are interested in crimes, as we all are, but appear to take great pleasure in loathing and despising attractive female criminals, murderesses? Carla was very pretty, the same as Casey Anthony, who had obviously been acquitted, and Jodi Arias. You have these pretty young ladies, and so there's fascination with them. That's sort of understandable, but the hatred is just amazing, which brings us to the post Lise LaSalle recently did, in which she says, you know, enough is enough. Leave Carla alone. She is rehabilitated. She's committed no crimes. She has three children, lives in the Caribbean, and a
Toronto... Has three children? How long has she been out?
Oh, I believe, I'd have to double check, but I think she got out in around 2005, I believe.
Oh, so she has three kids already?
She actually married, her husband is the, was the brother, I believe, of her last attorney.
Yeah, of course.
And so,
it's always funny how these people have, you know, great social lives in prison. You know, it's like
right. Well, Carla.
Some people,
one thing you can say for Carla, she was always good at meeting people, and you know, for better or for worse, she was, you know, she was very outgoing, and you know, she had charisma of her own, I think. And so,
Liz's? I didn't read the post. I have to say it yet. I'll take a look at it later. But was it Liz's contention that Carla really was just under Paul's spell, and she was being used by him, and therefore she is rehabilitated?
Because some people were
thinking this is someone who can't be rehabilitated because she is a complete sociopath. Okay, so what?
Right.
No, she
doesn't make that point at all. She makes the point that I think her sense is that, you know, certainly Carla was negatively influenced by Paul without a doubt, and but she covers Carla's press conference. First of all, she's changed her name legally to Leanne Teal. So she has a press conference on a French radio station when she's released. And in it, she expresses her extreme remorse for what she did. She talks about how, you know, as the years pass, it gets worse, not better. She's horrified by what she did. And, you know, she thinks about it every day. And, you know, she's stuck with what she did. She has to live with it for the rest of her life. Now, that's the only press conference she ever gave. And after that, she's hunted in Canada, which is why she moves to Guadalupe. And the punchline here is that a Canadian newswoman, apparently a, quote, victims' rights person named Paula Todd, tracks her to Guadalupe and blackmails her to get an interview. And and Carla, of course, is horrified to see, you know, Paula there. And the way Paula blackmails Carla is she says, look, if you don't give me an interview, I'm going to expose your address. By that point, people knew she was in Guadalupe, but didn't know exactly where she lived. And it's hardly like she was living on the beach and, you know, getting a good tan. She's, you know, she's inland. You know, it's probably very hot. There's probably lots of bugs, lots of mosquitoes. It's probably not the most pleasant life, but she's raising her kids there. Now, and so Paula Todd, so they have this really, you know.
Is she there with her husband? Is she still married to the guy?
She's there with her husband, exactly. She lives there with her husband.
See, some people would say that, and I see where the anger may come from, that people would say this woman really got away with a lot of murder, not just one murder. She only spent 12 years in prison. Now she gets to have a life. And she gets to have kids, which you might say maybe she shouldn't be reproducing. You know, so there's where I can see where the anger may come from. But, yes, on the other hand, you could also make the argument for, well, if she did her time, that was the deal. Now she's out. She has a right to make a life, and there's such a thing as redemption and reclaiming your life and all of that. But, you know, let's face it, 12 years for multiple murders, there are drug criminals who do a lot more. That's another whole story that they shouldn't be doing.
Right, and, you know, I recently saw, I came across, I'm not sure what the case is, but a case I came across last night where an American serial killer got 16 years and 8 months for, like, a whole bunch of murders. Oh. And, you know, so it's not that unusual for someone, you know, and, of course, that person, that was a woman, I believe, she testified. So that's not that unusual. Certainly, as you say, Amy Beth, there's two sides to the story. And I could see that people might feel skeptical that Carla, you know, probably, you know, perhaps shouldn't have children. You know, who's to say? Your point is very good. There are, on the other hand, there is such a thing as redemption. And,
I'm giving both points.
But what is curious is just the utter loathing in which she is held by Carla fans. It's like and we have another contributor.
Well, they're not really fans, they're anti-fans.
I mean they're like angry fans. They're obsessed with Carla. It's just working in the legal field as I do. It's just amazing to me that people who, you know, do not work in the legal field, they really know little about it. And, you know, they are so filled with vitriol and hatred. I mean, I have some clients who have done some really bad stuff. I certainly don't hate them. My job is to defend them. They're people just like anyone else. They have good points and bad points. And the fact that they're, you know, criminals doesn't faze me. And also, I'm not, like, particularly fascinated with them as they, you know, once you've, you know, dealt with 100 different criminals or more, you know, you see similarities.
Well, you are fascinated. You wouldn't be putting out the All Things Crime blog if you weren't fascinated to some extent, but you're not obsessed in the same way. I think what happens with people, it's like crime as entertainment. This is what has happened in our society where people watch these shows, and I'm guilty of it too, so I'm not blaming anybody or casting aspersions, but you start watching it, and it's the story that attracts me. But you do, for me, as a writer, certainly someone who writes mysteries and now trying to write psychological thrillers, I'm trying to dig into their psyches too, the criminal psyche, mm-hmm. and get involved with what's going on there. So I'm fascinated by all sides of the story, and I said before with the Carlos story, yeah, there is such a thing as redemption, which of course puts the whole criminal justice system on its head in some ways by saying, well, what is a good sentence and what is a good punishment and what really goes on in prisons too? Those are a whole other topics that we can get into, and the fairness of sentencing and why some people who have
nonviolent minor offenses... That's a
you know,
really
go to prison
good...
for 25 years and you can do manslaughter and get out less, you know, if you make a deal. Is that a good point? Look at this guy, James Arthur Ray, the self-help guru who just got released from prison, who was convicted of negligent homicide and that Sweat Lodge death, and the families are upset. He made that, I don't know if you saw it, that appearance on the Piers Morgan show a week or so ago, trying to make his mea culpas, and not to the satisfaction of most people who were involved with him. Because his attitude is, well, I've apologized.
Amy Beth?
Well, I think he got 3 years, and I think he did a little more than two.
Gotcha.
You know, they ran concurrently. He got 3 years for each. You know, he didn't do 3 years for each. It was a concurrent sentence for three deaths. And his attitude is, on the one hand, he's contrite. He feels bad that this happened and on his watch, and he doesn't know how it happened. And I don't believe he wanted them to die, don't get me wrong. I mean, it wasn't an intentional death, but it was such negligence. And the way he handled it afterwards and the way he handled it while they were suffering was just unconscionable. And he walked away and kind of acted like it was no big deal. And now he says, yeah, I understand it's horrible and I have to live with it, but, you know, there's nothing I can say and nothing is good enough. And he's just kind of nonchalant about it, where these people are suffering and they lost their loved ones. And I don't think he really quite gets it. And, by the way, he's going back and doing business. I think some people have indicated that while he was in prison, he may have been setting up his business with Kevin Trudeau. You know him, right? He's that infomercial scam guy who's now living in Switzerland because he's probably going to go back to prison.
Okay, yeah, I do know about him vaguely.
Yeah,
wow.
He also did federal time years ago before he became popular for fraud, and now he may go to prison again. He's the guy that does all those late-night infomercials with these books that he claims nobody wants you to know the secrets of, and he sells them for ridiculous amounts. Well, supposedly they were setting up some DVDs or CD kind of business for their self-help business while he was in prison. So he comes out on Piers Morgan, and Piers Morgan, who it turns out, gave him the biggest softball interview I've ever seen, and I was like, what's the deal with this guy? I find out later, Piers Morgan's manager is affiliated with James Arthur Ray.
How do you like that?
Whatever. They're all involved in that. And he only agreed to do the interview if they wouldn't have anybody else on, so the other victims' families can come on or whatever. And he, you know, just gave him kind of a softball interview. And he kind of acted like I'm not sure what I'm going to do now. Like he didn't act like he didn't own up to the fact that he's revving up his business again. And Piers Morgan throws him a softball and says, well, you're probably in a better position now to help people after you went through this nightmarish experience. Like now that you've paid you went to prison for a couple of years, and I'm not saying it was pleasant, but it was a couple of years. These other people are dead. They're still dead. You know? And I guess, you know, I understand the argument. You can't ever bring that back, and you can never repay it. But it doesn't, I don't know that he's showing redemption by revving up his Twitter account with, you know, affirmations and putting up a website and selling CDs and DVDs at high prices and, you know, revving up to get ready for his seminars. I mean, I predicted this, actually. I wrote an article about it when he just went to prison. I followed the story and interviewed a few people involved at the time. And I remember saying, one of my comments was, I wonder what's going to happen when he comes out, but I'm sure it's going to be the Mea Culpa talk show tour. And here it is, with a repackaging
of the
snake oil.
So you nailed that ahead of time.
I did. Well, come
on. So you had a sense of who he is. You must have had a sense of his callousness and his, like, just self-absorption and, you know, putting himself first.
Yeah, because Yes, because he made up so much stuff about his life, too. He lied about his credentials. He lied about his background. He said to people, which I felt would have been a real red flag had you been involved. I mean, I never heard of the guy before this happened, frankly, so I don't know how I guess he had become popular because he was involved with The Secret, and he showed up on the Oprah show. And by the way, he still has on his website, his revamped website, a video with him on the Oprah show. And a lot of people, the victim's families included, are very outraged that Oprah is still... Oprah never came out and unendorsed him. You know, she endorsed him, I guess, when The Secret came out, which has also been debunked as a big sham. But, you know, he's there, and he still has the same video with him. But he really Yeah, good.
Yeah, so this is a very slippery fellow, to say the least.
Oh, yeah, I think so. He's
sure sounds that way.
But he said to his followers, what I was going to say before, he said to a group of his inner circle when he was gaining popularity before this tragedy happened, he said he wanted to be the first spiritual guru billionaire. This was his goal. And my point is it's a big billion-dollar industry, no question about it, but if that's your goal and you're selling spiritual enlightenment, that's not a goal that you want your spiritual guru to at least admit to, I don't think. You know, to me, that would be, you know, why do you have to...
At least teach it to yourself.
Yeah, right. But why do you have to pay... I'm all for self-help and self-improvement and all of that, but why do you have to pay tens of thousands of dollars for a one-week workshop or a one-week retreat where you're living in very Spartan conditions and basically starving yourself and going to rituals? I mean, you know, that's you have to question yourself. Do you really have to pay that much? Is it really worth it that much? I mean, you know, the price tag is not always commensurate with what you get out of it. And I think some of these people need to... And the dangers, just the dangers of what he put these people through and so forth. And he made a bunch of excuses on the Piers Morgan show that I just don't think, you know, he tried to couch it in, I'm taking responsibility, but, you know, it's all this but, there's always a but there. Instead of just, as some people said, what he would do to show true redemption, I think, is to walk in, get out of prison and then go do something quiet, not go buy a TV and not start up this business again. Go ditch some, go dig some ditches or something.
Well, I think this is very, I think this really, sheds light on the Carla situation, because if you compare that to what Carla's done, Carla left Canada, moved to and lives a very quiet life in a faraway place and does her best to stay out of the public eye. And so it really does, cast her in a very different light than this James Arthur Ray guy who, you know, sounds pretty despicable. As you describe him.
Yeah, well, he seems like it. I mean, we'll see what he does. It just seems to me, again, it's not my job to slam him. I'm just saying it from what I'm observing. If he wanted to really achieve redemption, you think he would go live a quiet life. Carla, maybe doing that. On the other hand, she had no choice in a way, right? I mean, if she didn't want to be hounded, she had to relocate somewhere.
Right, and that's part of the point of our post is that. The Canadian society just hounded her relentlessly. Initially, she got a job working in a hardware store, and the guy she was working for, he tape-recorded conversations, made up stories. She was she had probation or parole regulations she had to follow. She wasn't allowed to associate with kids under the age of 16, that sort of thing. And so this guy tape-recorded conversations, went to the cops, told them a bunch of fibs, and which, you know, she was later exonerated on all accounts. So that was one job she couldn't keep. And that was typical of society's attitude. And see what I'm getting from you, Amy Beth. I mean, you bring up very good points with James Arthur Ray. This guy appears to be dangerous. This guy appears to be phony. This guy appears to be despicable. This guy appears to have no remorse. But I don't imagine that you hate James Arthur Ray. I would imagine...
No, I don't. Yeah.
That I would imagine that you are, you are justly skeptical of the guy and, are concerned and, this guy needs to be stopped or this guy right. May kill again.
Well, no, I don't hate him, but I'm sure the family members of his victims do. I mean, I have no personal relation to him. I just follow the story and talk
right.
to some of the victims.
Right, but see, the haters of Carla, they have no personal relationship either. Of course, the families and the families of the victims are entitled to, to hate, to loathe Carla, to feel whatever they choose to feel. That's their right. But the haters of Carla have no more personal relationship to her than you do to James Arthur Ray.
Well, they become obsessed. Yeah, but what I said before, they become obsessed with the story, like the Arias haters, you know, people who become obsessed with Jody Arias and that kind of thing, who, by the way, is back in the news because there was that story last week, which may or may not be credible, about her ordering a hit on Juan Martinez, the prosecutor in her case. A former cellmate came out, you know the story, right, who said she was him to give him a mafia bow tie, which sounds gruesome. We won't go into exactly what that is.
I'm very skeptical of that story because Jody Arias, did she have any underworld? Is there any evidence she's ever had any underworld connections? First of all, I don't think there is any, though I'm not certain, I don't think there is any such evidence.
And, no, but she may be delusional that she could get somebody to do her dirty work for her, some guy, some thug. I'm sure she has correspondence with people who are, you know, probably saying they'll do something for her. Don't you think? I'm guessing.
It's possible, yeah. I mean, I really don't know. I don't give any credence to that story without proof. As it just sounds like, you know, an inmate, you know, trying to get it.
Yeah, get her moments. Yeah. Well, she has some crackpot tendencies, it seems, this woman. So it's possible. Of course, Jody is interesting for. Yeah. Go ahead.
I did see something that the woman, the informant, apparently does have some crackpot tendencies, which makes me, you know, doubt her all the more.
Exactly. But Jody's back. It's interesting that the retrial, if and when it ever happens, and by the way, it is the retrial for the sentencing. Again, the people that are obsessed with Jody Arias getting away with murder, she's not getting away with murder. She's been convicted of murder.
She's
because
doing
Arizona
life in
has
prison
a crazy
for murder.
Law.
She's doing life
exactly,
in prison
I mean,
at the very least.
Right, but Arizona has, it's Arizona's fault, and I also feel badly for the jury because it's not the jury's fault, it's the Arizona law. They really should have, like most states have, if they can't come to a consensus on the death penalty, the jury, it goes directly to the judge, and that's it. It's not like you have a second bite of the apple, and then the judge gives life or whatever it is. I think in some states, like Florida, I don't think you have to be unanimous. It could be a majority on the jury, but whatever the rules are, it's a one-shot deal, and then it goes to the judge. It's not, you don't get a second shot at it, which I don't understand why they have that in Arizona, because that, besides being such a tension for the families, it's also a huge expense to the taxpayers. Here we go again. This is going on and on and on. So I don't know if it's going to happen in January or not. I guess Sherry Stevens eventually will retry the penalty phase. But the interesting thing is it will not be televised. So, of course,
I heard that it won't be televised, and I heard that it's all of a sudden, instead of the circus that, you know, took place before, it'll be just the opposite. Do you know anything about the mediation, the arbitration that was supposed to take place? Do you know if
mediation
that actually... There was arbitration or mediation with Jody Arias' lawyers and lawyers for the prosecution, in which I guess there's a rule that they, in theory at least, could come up with an agreement as far as what the sentence should be, and that would keep it from having to go back to the jury for a second trial. And that story has just kind of faded away. And I'm just wondering...
I think that has been hanging out there since, you know, after they came down with the non-verdict, the penalty non-verdict. I think, from what I understood, they kept saying the prosecution isn't going to give in, and basically it would be life if she agreed to life without parole, without doing appeals, which I think would be the best thing. But I don't see that she would ever agree to that. What's in it for her to agree to that?
That is the prosecutor. That who wouldn't agree to it, Jody? Or the prosecution?
Yeah, the prosecution supposedly doesn't want to agree to it because the family is hell-bent against giving her anything short of the death penalty. But I'm saying I don't know that Jody would agree to life without parole, without appeal, because to me, Jody wants to be in the news as much as she can, and she wants to hang on every appeal she can come up with, et cetera. But, you know, she claims to the public via her Twitter account or whatever that she wants to make a deal, and she's always wanted to make a deal and all that. But I don't really think she wants to make a deal. I think she likes the idea of being in the news as much as she can. That's my theory. I don't know. I could be wrong.
Yeah, well,
but,
that could very well be possible. She does seem to have a flair for the limelight.
Yeah, she does. A little bit, you think? But the prosecution and the family, I think they're being too stubborn, too, because she's going to wind up with life in prison, whether she gets the death penalty or not, you know, in reality, because it takes so long, and I think with the appeals process. Plus, frankly, the way I've heard it, I could be wrong on this and I'm an expert, but I've heard other people talking about it who say that if she gets the death penalty the way that works, the appeal process there goes to a different court, which will be more likely to overturn the whole darn thing and we'll have to start from scratch, than if she gets life in prison, it goes to a different appeals set.
Would have to start from scratch as far as the penalty phase.
No, the whole thing. In other words, she would be more likely to throw out the entire conviction. Like, there's another woman who
really?
Was on death row in Arizona at the same time that the Jody Arias trial was going on. I don't know the particulars of the case, but the case was thrown out, and now she gets to start over. from scratch. She gets the conviction thrown out, and she gets a new trial. So, you know, the family is probably better off letting her get life in prison and throwing away the key. I mean, I can't imagine Sherry Stevens giving her life with the possibility of parole. I just can't see it.
I quite agree. It's very unlikely that would happen.
She'd have to move down and live with Carla in Guadalupe. I mean, you know, that's not going to happen. So I'm just saying, if you give her life, throw away the key, there still will be some appeals, I guess, unless she agreed to no appeals if they made a deal. But she would pop up every 10 years or so when the appeals, 5-10 years, whenever they get up the chain of command and they get denied or accepted or whatever it is. But I think with the death penalty, it's such a bigger scrutiny on that, on the trial itself, that she may wind up getting a redo. Can you imagine redoing it in 10 years? I mean,
no,
that would be truly strange
and extraordinary.
Yeah, but look at the Michael Skakel case in Connecticut. Michael Skakel, who was convicted of the 1975 murder of his teenage friend, Martha Moxley, finally convicted, I think, 2002, 2003, spent about a decade behind bars. They just overturned the conviction on the basis of ineffective assistance of counsel, and he's going to get a retrial.
I wanted to ask you about that because I know you did some journalism at the time of the trial, right?
Yes, I was hosting a radio show in Greenwich, Connecticut, where this took place, by the way, at the time. So I had access regularly to Mickey Sherman, who was the lead defense attorney. He would call on the show regularly. And also Dominic Dunn, the late journalist and author, who was not a Skakel fan. He followed the trial, called me from the courthouse, and actually called me before the trial was over. And I have that interview. I've got to get it somehow redigitized so we can get it on the Internet. Fascinating interview. But he talked about, at that point, the prosecution was just about resting and the defense was coming up. And he said, his quote was that Mickey Sherman was a brilliant attorney and he was creating, he feared, because again, he was for Michael Skakel being convicted. He feared that Sherman was creating reasonable doubt. This was before the trial, you know, when they got the verdict. And really, after the fact, I talked to him and he said the only thing that really turned the case, he thought they were going to acquit him because based on Sherman's performance, but because the prosecutor, Jonathan Benedict, put on such a great closing, that sums up the jury.
So Mickey Sherman put on a complete defense.
Well, Mickey, according to Dominic Dunn and others, that's why it was shocking that the reason why they overturned the case, this one judge, for ineffective assistance of counsel, which is usually a very low bar. You know this, working in the criminal end of things. Usually, I mean, even if a lawyer is sleeping, usually they say it's enough. You know, it's like a very basic thing, and I'm sure Sherman, who, yes, is a flamboyant guy, and he loved the media and all of that, but still, they said he put on a good defense. He pushed he did bring up other possible...
Well, he must have, if Dominic Dunn was concerned there was going to be that Skakel would be acquitted. So tell me this, Amy Beth, since you know the case so well, and we're running a series on it, and our writer who is in New England, she's going to get to the trial, I think, in her next episode. But so what was the evidence against Skakel? This is what I'm curious about, because what I now know about the case, it just seems so undetermined or indeterminate.
A lot of it relied on his own words to other people, and this is where it gets sketchy, because you remember this happened in 1975 when he was a kid, and you know he had a lot of problems. His family was a huge family. The mother had passed away. There were a lot of boys in the family. They were kind of unruly. The father, who is Effa Kennedy's brother, Rushton Skakel, I think he had passed away since. He really couldn't handle the kids that well. I mean, he was busy with work, et cetera. He hired this tutor, Ken Littleton, who they tried to – a lot of people cast aspersions on him, and that was his first day on the job, I think. This is talk about unlucky when this happened. But a lot of it was Michael Skakel's own confessions. He went to this Elan school in Maine, which is this, like, drug rehab place, and apparently one with a very bad reputation for treating their students, patients, whatever. And apparently he confessed to somebody there. That person testified initially, I guess, in preliminary hearings and depositions, but then by the time the trial came, he had overdosed, and he was dead, but they let it in the testimony. You know, this is why it's going to be harder, and it gets harder and harder to try cases, because people die and forget and all that other stuff. They had the golf club from the family that somebody had hidden. The other thing, the big smoking gun, well, it wasn't really a smoking gun, but a big thing was they had hired the original suspect was not Michael, it was Tommy Skakel.
It was Tommy, the older brother.
Yeah,
sure.
The older brother, who I guess had either a flirtation or a relationship with Martha, it's unclear, and Michael...
He definitely had a flirtation. In fact, in our series, earlier on the night that she's murdered, he's flirting heavily with her, and they're kind of jumping around, rolling around in the leaves a bit. It's on Halloween night, and you know, they're having lots of fun together.
This is Tommy and Martha Moxley.
The contention
was that Michael was jealous of this. I mean, this is a theory. But they hired, because Tommy became the big suspect, I guess, for a lot of people, although he wasn't arrested. The Skakel family, Rushton Skakel, hired the Sutton agency, this private investigative agency, to look into it. And they did this report, but the guy who did the report said, you're not going to be happy with what we found, because instead of Tommy, they pointed the finger at Michael. And then they tried to suppress the report. It was all these you know, complicated things. But yes, in terms of physical evidence, you're right. That's why I would be surprised. It would be easier to say they overturned it based on no evidence rather than ineffective assistance of counsel, because there seems to be a lot of it is based on stories, but a lot of it is Michael confessing to people because he had a big drug problem, and some people could argue because he was so guilty that his life kept spiraling downward. I mean, if you see what he looked like when he was a kid to what he looks like now, I mean, he's 15.
Oh, I know. I have seen the pictures. In fact, we posted the pictures.
When he was convicted, he was 40. He looked like he was 60. I mean, you know, I think life takes its toll. And, of course, somehow during the time of while this was all hanging over his head, he managed to get married and have a child and then get divorced. So, these people having kids and, you know, while all this bad stuff is happening in their life, I question. But
well, there is evidence that certainly that someone out of the Skakel household was responsible, because what I've learned from our contributor Martha Garrett in New England is writing the posts, and both Michael Skakel's life spiraled downhill very dramatically. Also, Ken Littleton's life spiraled downhill very dramatically. As far as Tommy Skakel, he apparently has lived very quietly and rather reclusively, and I don't think there is the dramatic downward spiral in his case, but rather he's just tried to stay out of the limelight. So it's curious that both Littleton and Michael Skakel's lives have deteriorated as they have. And, of course, it's possible. I mean, it's just idle conjecture. Maybe Littleton knows something. He's haunted
maybe
by that.
I think it's pretty clear that Littleton was not if there's somebody else outside the family, there are other suspects, but I suspect that's not the case. I don't want to...
Right, Littleton didn't do it, clearly.
I don't think Littleton did it. I think the problem with Littleton, I don't know what his mental state was before he got involved with this, but because it was... he had that cloud over his head the whole time, and I think that has to weigh heavily on you, you know, and the pressure and all of that. There were other suspects. I mean, if you read Mark Furman had a book about it too, Murder in Greenwich, which really, the thing is, Dominic Dunn wrote a novel before called A Season in Purgatory, which was loosely based on the case.
Mm-hmm.
And then he met Mark Furman and gave Mark Furman the idea to reopen it, and he wrote a nonfiction version, you know, a nonfiction book called Murder in Greenwich, and that kind of really started the investigation again after many years of it laying dormant. And I remember I interviewed the chief detective on the case, Steve Carroll, who now passed away. Again, all these people passing away isn't going to help them, you know, in the retrial. So I think the prosecution is hoping they can overturn the overturn. You know what I mean? They're appealing the overturn from the judge. Otherwise, I think he is just going to walk with the 10 years in prison, and we're never going to know what really happened, I guess. Although Mrs.
Right.
Moxley...
That's interesting. So it'll be harder. It'll be much harder to reconvict him. So unless they can overturn the overturn, the prosecution may be out of luck here.
I think he's probably going to walk, and we're never really going to know. Although Moxley still believes steadfastly that he is the one who did it, and that had he confessed when he was 16 years old or 15 years old, he would have gone to juvenile jail back in those days, because in the 70s they didn't have, you know, they wouldn't.
He would have also being from a privileged family. That's very interesting. Yeah, so he probably would have been out by the time he was 21 or so.
Yeah, he would have been out, and he might have, if he did in fact do it, he might have been able to get some resolution within himself and be able to live a better life. I mean, so that's part of the argument. I think that's what her comment that she made, which I think she's a very gracious woman, Mrs. Moxley, by the way.
I think she gave a brief press conference.
And she said something about...
She's sort of a legend in New England, right?
Well, yeah, I guess. Well, now she moved. I don't think she lives in New England anymore. I think she lives in Virginia. But she did say that this is a lesson for parents to deal with their problems when they happen. In other words, as I said, if he had dealt with it then, He could have had it behind him, and he could have had a life and a healthier life, as opposed to chasing this demon around through drugs and through having, you know, the suspicion around him, and then having to go through the trial and all of this years later, and dragging it out for the Moxleys, because nothing is going to bring back the daughter that they lost, but certainly all those years of it hanging over everybody's heads and wondering exactly what happened and wanting justice. It's interesting because when the case came back into the news when it was retried, there was an interesting reaction of people that were either very interested in it, or in Greenwich, people who were saying, well, why are we bothering with this again? It was from this idea, like, you know, why bring it up again now, which I thought was a strange reaction. You know, like, it's dead and buried. It was a long time ago. Why resurrect it? And simply because, you know, there is no statute of limitations on murder, folks, so people are resurrecting it. But there was a sense of it, maybe because he came from a privileged family and they wanted to keep, you know, it was the privileged group that were kind of saying, you know, let's not go there again, that kind of thing.
What was the year of the conviction?
I think it was 2002.
Okay, 2002, so he did about, so Skakel did about 10 years then.
Yes, he did about 10 years. And he probably would, but the thing is, he ironically would have done a lot less had he admitted to it or been convicted of it as a child back in the 70s. Now, maybe not so much if he was tried as an adult, but in those days. So yeah, you could say that, you know, he has done some prison time and that's it, but it's an interesting, it's just an interesting way, and Mickey Sherman, of course, who is a character, has been pretty classy about it and hasn't said much except that he always believed in Michael's innocence because he's now being, you know, in other words, he's being blamed for the conviction, and I don't think that's right.
There is a tendency among good lawyers to graciously fall on the sword when it's necessary for their clients. That is, they tend to be quite willing to do that, even though it may temporarily reflect on them and their status as top flight lawyers. They typically don't fight falling on the sword when it's necessary.
But it's almost pro forma that they always will file an appeal based on ineffective assistance of counsel, and it's also almost pro forma that it gets turned down because, as I said before,
right,
the bar
exactly.
is, and you know this better than I, is very low, right? You know, so that's why it's funny because it does seem like you can't really make the case in this for Sherman, which is why the prosecution may have, and I don't know if they do, but they may have some hope in overturning that and have, you know, overturning, however you call that.
Well, that suggests, since I mean, you were there, Sherman put on a good defense. The ineffective assistance of counsel seems absurd, so that suggests that, once again, people in high places are pulling strings here.
Maybe. But, you know, it's funny because I know the other question I had for Dominic Dunn, I wasn't in the courtroom. I was just observing it. And, of course, in Connecticut, they don't have – or they didn't at that time. I don't know if they do now. They don't have – didn't have cameras in the courtroom. But Dominic Dunn – because I asked him, was there a big Kennedy showing? And there were no Kennedys that came. So Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who has been a big spokesperson for the family now and who is very outraged at Mickey Sherman and Dominic Dunn, he had a feud with all of these people, and outraged at the conviction, really had nothing to say during the trial. So you think if they were going to pull strings, they should have pulled strings during the first trial rather than, you know, wait 10 years and start pulling strings now, because it's very difficult once you're convicted. As you know, it's not like on TV. You don't get out the next day, even if new evidence emerges. You have to go through a big process. So, you know,
A curious thing, one of the things our writer unearthed is that Michael Skakel, of all things, he was a whistleblower in his own right, and he blew the whistle on one of those Kennedy figures, I think Michael Kennedy Smith, or one of them who had an illicit dalliance with an underage babysitter. And apparently Michael Skakel turned Kennedy Smith, or one of those figures, turned him in. And according to our writer, at that point, the Kennedys as a clan turned against Skakel and withdrew any support for him, which was why he then, without the Kennedy support, that's why the case came to trial fairly soon after that. Whether that's true or not, I have no idea, but it's an interesting angle.
That is interesting. I hadn't heard that. That may be true, but then now suddenly they're back in, not suddenly, but after the conviction they became, I know Bobby Kennedy had an article in the Atlantic Monthly about it. I mean, then they suddenly came to the fore. So it's like, I don't know why they were waiting. If they wanted to pull any strings or any weight, why didn't they get moving sooner, is my point, rather than waiting.
Yeah, well, they figured, we'll let him do 10 years.
Let him do a little time.
Come to his rescue.
let him cool his heels.
He's an embarrassment to the family, so let him be locked up for 10 years. But then after a while, okay, we'll give the guy a break. He's not doing well.
Maybe. Yeah, we'll see what happens. But it's a fascinating case. It was a fascinating case. It still is. But I think if they retry it, it's going to be even harder to make a case because I think a lot of witnesses are older, deader. You know, it's just going to be harder. It was hard to begin with, so I think it's even harder. But it is fascinating. Of course, there are other people in the news. Quickly, before we let you go, we got to do it. We got to talk George Zimmerman. The guy just can't, although he hasn't been in the news the last couple of weeks, but he's back in trouble, and we knew it was going to happen. We just didn't know how quickly it was going to happen, that he has this new problem with a new girlfriend. And the character that I find most fascinating in the whole case is his pal, this Frank Taffy guy who comes on TV and defends him to the hilt. What's your take on Zimmerman?
Okay, tell me about him. I'm not up to speed on that.
You're not an HLN viewer, I guess, because Frank Taffy is this guy who was a former neighbor of Zimmerman's who, during the trial for the killing of Trayvon Martin, would come on and defend, you know, Zimmerman to the hilt. After the fact, he's defended him every time he gets into one of his little brushes with the law. And his big argument always with them, they say, why does he need to have a gun? He always whips out the Second Amendment. He has the right to carry a gun. Well, the right to carry a gun and the need to carry the gun are two different things. But, you know, they go through that whole argument every time. And his new theory with this new girlfriend is that she wanted to make a deal and get some money out of George. And since George has no money now, she wants to get a deal from the media and get paid for an interview or a book deal of her own. And the same thing with Shelley. And they're all opportunists, and they're all working together against George. It's a whole big conspiracy. And you should feel sorry for George because he's suffering from undiagnosed, untreated PTSD after his experience with Trayvon Martin and the trial. And therefore, he's allowed to have all the guns he has because we know when he was arrested, how many guns did this guy? They took a cache of guns out of the house.
Yeah, I think six guns or so and a bunch of ammo.
If you have PTSD, that's a good thing to do is have guns. And he was on Piers Morgan, Piers Morgan did not throw him a softball. He said, well, why does he have to have the guns, the usual question. And he said, well, Piers, you know, boys will have their toys. This set Piers Morgan, who's a big anti-gun person, into a big furor. It was a very good TV, and they had a big thing. And he said, oh, just a figure of speech and just making a joke. It was this whole big thing. And then Gloria Allred came on and became, for one reason or another, the voice of reason. So you're missing cable TV if you don't watch some of these.
I would watch more than I do, but I just simply don't have the time. With my job and trying to run the blog,
yeah.
It's like there would need to be three of me for me to while away hours
happily
watching HLN.
You could get a lot of information from that for your article. So, but anyway.
Oh, I know, but I just do not have the opportunity.
But he is quite a colorful character, and I don't get him at all. But he obviously has some issues of his own. But so, what's your take? I know you're amused by Zimmerman. Are you still amused by Zimmerman? Because I think he's a scary time. You know, he's a time bomb.
Well, I mean, I have felt that too. I've stated all along that he's a time bomb waiting to go off. At the same time, in this sort of, and it's probably just my somewhat I refer to as my jocularly cynical sense of humor. I just get a kick out
yeah.
of the idea of this large nutcase roaming around just, you know, frantically doing this and that. Hopefully, because he has been arrested and there are, you know, there are charges, and which may or may not be felony charges, but they very well could be. Hopefully, hopefully this will stop him and he'll do some time. On the other hand, if he does do time, it won't be that much time, probably. He'll get out. And, I mean, you're very right. It's true, Amy Beth. I mean, he is a dangerous guy. And I suppose I'm treating him like he's just this, like, comical nutcase. It's probably a defensive measure of sorts because I don't want to think about how scary and dangerous George Zimmerman is. I mean, he's already killed someone for no good reason, in my opinion. And but he is, he's sort of at the same time, he's a larger-than-life, like, you know, comic figure. I mean, his absurd actions just make me laugh despite myself. It probably says more about me than it does about Zimmerman.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, I see where you're coming from on that, and we talk about him because he seems to be another person like Anarius who craves the attention. Maybe, you know, his wife, I think, and his girlfriend were, I don't know about the girlfriend, because I don't know if she did come out and talk, even though she supposedly wants an interview. But I think the wife alluded to the fact that he doesn't have the attention now that he had initially, and that bothers him. So he does seem to want that attention. He does seem to be very narcissistic. I just... it's funny, I guess, in a way, because he keeps coming up and doing these things and then blaming other people for why the media is focusing on him. You know, so like, if you're going to do this stuff, you're going to get attention, let's face it. But or he has his friends doing it for him, like Frank Taffy. But my point is, he has already killed an unarmed teenager. I think he also, I believe, he was wrongly acquitted. And I don't want somebody else to get hurt before he gets stopped. I wish he would just get stopped now. Let's get stopped before. And people who surround him, and it's not just Frank Taffy, it's also his former attorney, Mark O'Mara, who was on TV, who's no longer his attorney, but he claimed he's still his friend. He owes him a bunch of money. He says he doesn't think he's ever getting that money. And the chances are dwindling with his latest actions. But he also said, you know, that George is a great guy, who is suffering also from post-traumatic stress disorder and needs help and needs compassion, yada, yada, yada. But nobody says, if that's true, and of course they say he was never like that before, which is not true, because there's evidence, and you've reported in your own site, that he had that run-in with the police,
He had several run-ins, if I'm not mistaken. He was always a dangerous guy.
Yeah, he worked as a bouncer. He had a problem. He had a previous girlfriend who couldn't be looking for publicity because this was long before he was ever on the radar, who accused him of domestic violence. I mean, there are a lot of these things that happened that didn't come out in the trial, which I think I credit either the prosecution for dropping the ball or the judge for not letting it in, because they opened the door on the defense side when they brought those fools on to say that he's, you know, a lover, not a fighter. Remember that guy who owned the gym and all that stuff. So there was evidence that he was a troubled, dangerous guy before. But even if you believe that, Mark O'Mara, your selective memory, then why don't you encourage him to get rid of the guns and get some professional help? This idea that he should be armed because, you know, more people are out to get him, but he also has a bodyguard. So we don't need a bodyguard.
You're really approaching the deeper issue there of the American obsession with being armed and dangerous, as if being armed and dangerous is more important than the safety of citizens, and really more important than the way I see it is, I just see it as this like deeply rooted like childishness in the American male, which is just once again and viewed in my jocularly cynical way, it's like comical. It's like, what the heck? I mean, are you serious? Don't you realize you're acting like, you know, like a 7-year-old? And that's what the armed and dangerous American males, that's what we're like.
You're acting like, it's one thing to be a 7-year-old watching a Three Stooges movie or a Farrelly Brothers movie or something like that, making stupid jokes, even drinking a little bit too much, although drinking and driving isn't a good idea. But when you start mixing in guns, when you start mixing in things where you can actually hurt yourself or other people, emphasis on the other people, then that's another story where the joke kind of goes away. And I think Zimmerman has proven that.
It's horrible. Exactly. It's horrible. And once again, that's just my way of, you know, my defensive mechanism, because the situation is so awful.
You don't want to face what can happen if he does.
We've talked about this before. A large part of the nation is armed and dangerous, and there's nothing we can do about it, because the legislation has made it, as the years have passed, easier and easier for people to have guns, people who should not. And so, there's nothing really that we can do about it.
But he has people around him, though, who could help him. That's what I'm saying, to try to help him. Maybe they are privately doing it, and they're just saying something differently publicly, I suppose.
Right.
They're
enabling him, of course. And it stands to reason that a guy like Zimmerman would be surrounded by a bunch of enablers. I mean, unhealthy situation.
But you think his attorney or his former attorney would give him one of those, you know, strong talking to's, like, listen, George, you know, you really do need help. You got to not have the guns. You got to look at yourself closely. You've been through a traumatic experience. Even if it's justified, I mean, when police officers have what they call a righteous shoot, they turn in their guns for a while. They have to go to counseling. It's mandated. A lot of times, police officers then don't want to go back and carry a gun again. They want to resign. I mean, it's so traumatic an experience, and that's what I'm thinking.
That's a very good point, and that's interesting. I had never heard that before, and that makes me respect these police officers, because they've come to grips with the enormity of carrying guns and shooting people and what it means and why it's a bad thing, and they're taking steps to not do it again, completely antithetical to what Zimmerman has done, in that he, you know, is more heavily armed. Well, until he got arrested, he was more heavily armed than ever.
I know, and the thing is, they talk about, like his friend Frank will talk about how he's a very spiritual, religious guy, so it's a heavy thing that he had to kill this kid. Well, then you don't have to rearm yourself. That's what I'm saying. You know, it's like, you talk about redemption, what you're talking about with Carla and James Arthur Ray and all these people. Redemption, if you want to redeem yourself, it's not redemption, if you believe you had no choice, okay, even if you believe that, even if you convince yourself of that, you think you would be so, oh my God, I actually killed somebody. Let me never put myself in a position where I can do that again. And the way to do that is to make sure you don't have a gun. Not let me arm myself even more.
Well, but that's assuming that somebody like Zimmerman does have an ethical or a moral core. And I'm, you know, not at all convinced that he does.
Oh, I'm not either. Oh, I'm definitely not convinced of that. But I'm saying they're trying to purport that he is, that he's a spiritual guy. I mean, remember when he was on Sean Hannity, that infamous interview where he said it was God's will. The whole thing was God's will. It was sort of like, no, I wouldn't change anything, including the death of this poor kid. I mean, that was really...
Yeah, well, what you're telling me, Amy Beth, it's making me dislike him more and more.
Well, there you go.
As
my work here is done.
some of this I wasn't aware of. I did predict over and over again that it was only a matter of time till Zimmerman would get arrested. And it's funny. Well, here's an interesting thing. The day that he did get arrested, I was at home probably doing the morning posts, and then I drive to work, drive to Los Angeles, and I'm just thinking, yeah, boy, we haven't heard from Big George for a while.
Ah.
And then within an hour or so, well, we hear from Big George. He's been popped.
Ooh, you're psychically connected. That's very dangerous. Patrick Moore, you are one hard-working guy, I'll tell you. I hope you have a little time to decompress and relax over the holidays and the holiday season. And I wish you a very merry, whatever it is you celebrate, and a happy new year. I know we'll be talking to you again in the new year because, you know, they keep committing crimes and you keep writing about them, and we keep talking about
them. Yeah, they don't seem to be going away anytime in the near future. Well, thanks so much, Amy Beth. A pleasure as always. And that was very illuminating for me as far as the Skakel situation is. That was some information that I certainly didn't know. Yeah. And thanks for bringing up the Carla situation. Is that's something I feel pretty strong about, and I know my contributor Lise LaSalle does. And we, you know, it created a lot of controversy on the blog. It brought some of the haters out of the woodwork. And,
well, you always love that. That's good for business. Bring the haters out of the woodwork, right?
Well, I'm not sure if it's good for business or not, but it certainly shows that, you know, we live in a strange land with some strange folks, and it's not likely to change soon.
Absolutely. Well, so that, therefore we'll be talking again. That's the good news. Thank you
right.
so much, Patrick. Always a pleasure.
Oh, okay. See you soon. Bye, Amy Beth.
Take care. Bye bye. That's Patrick Moore, the All Things Crime blog. Check it out. There are fascinating stories on there. He's got some historical ones, too, that are fascinating. Hey, thank you so much for joining us. We've got to wrap things up coming up on Friday. We will have Rick Goldschmidt. He gives us the behind-the-scenes look at all those great specials you love, like Frosty the Snowman and Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. He is the official historian of the Rankin-Bass Company. And Rudolph, by the way, is celebrating his 50th anniversary next year. And I will also talk to Tara Tomachik. She's back with us. Remember that movie Muted? They were having a Kickstarter campaign to get that socially conscious short off the ground. Guess what? They did it. They made the movie. She's going to talk to us about how it all came together, the impressive cast she assembled, and the film's future on the festival circuit. Free flow pop culture combo, inspiration to action, challenge, success stories, and yeah, we'll dip into the holiday group for the holiday songs. I'm going to send you out one for the criminals, because they ain't getting nothing for Christmas. Have a great week. Thank you, Trudy. Thank you, Aurora. Thank you, ML. Please drive safe, play nice, dream big, come back and see us on the Amy Beth Arkowitz Show. Take care.
I broke my bat on Johnny's head. Somebody snitched on me. I hit a frog in sister's bed. Somebody snitched on me. I spilled some ink on mommy's rug. I made Tommy eat a bug. Bought some gum with a penny slug. Somebody snitched on me. So I'm getting nothing for Christmas. Mommy and Daddy are mad. I'm getting nothing for Christmas. Cause I ain't been nothing but bad. I put a tack on teacher's chair. Somebody snitched on me. me. I tied a knot in Susie's hair. Stop me. I did a dance on Mommy's plant. Climbed a tree and tore my pants. Filled a sugar bowl with ants. Somebody snitched on me. Oh, hurry up. I'm getting nothing by Christmas. Mommy and Daddy are mad. I'm getting nothing by Christmas. Cause I ain't been nothing but bad. I won't be seeing Santa Claus. Somebody snitched on me. He won't come visit me because somebody snitched on me. Next year I'll be going straight. Next year I'll be good. Just wait. I start now, but it's too late. Somebody. Who's that coming down the chimney with a bag over his shoulder? It's him! It's him! I thought he wasn't coming!
Where's the silverware, little boy?
In a dining room, like I told you.
And the jewelry?
Same place as last time. How about my cut?
The usual?
The usual. Join me on a chorus, okay?
Why not?
I'm getting nothing for Christmas. Mommy and Daddy are mad. I'm getting nothing for Christmas. Cause I ain't been nothing but bad. Have a good season?
Excellent.
Do you have a receipt for this sweater?
No, ma'am. I don't have a receipt. I'm a shoplifter.
Feliz Navidad. Feliz Navidad. Feliz Navidad. Prospero año y felicidad.